This is the current federal tax developments for the week of March the 25th, 2019. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and we're going to be talking this week about what's gone on in the area of taxes in this past week. We'll have a brief discussion about some issues that are being discussed regarding qualified business income and disallowed passive losses as CPAs are discussing how their tax software is dealing with those situations. We'll talk about a case that dealt with the minister's housing allowance and whether it is constitutional. We'll deal with a pilot who ended up was being found to have no profit motive for restoring a vintage aircraft. We also have the IRS doing the unusual step of suspending two revenue rulings, which are related to the active trader business issues under Section 355 of the code. And finally, we're going to discuss a late in the week release of relief from the underpayment of estimated tax penalties. The IRS expanded relief they had granted earlier in the year, but that also means that we're going to have returns that have already been filed and people who've already paid taxes that now have paid penalties they have a right to get out of. We'll discuss how you can recover those penalties as we talk a bit more about what's going on. Well, it's springtime. And springtime means that, yes, we're getting close to baseball season. Out here in Phoenix, of course, the Cactus League has been running for a while, and spring training has been underway, but we're getting ready to start the baseball season, and that means, hey, we're getting toward the end of tax season. That's kind of how the two come together. So, no, we don't end tax season in time to be out for opening day, but basically we'll end it so that we're early in the season, and for some of you, we'll end it, you know, before we end it, it's probably going to be too cold to be out there much, you know, wanting to be in the stands potentially. So, well, but it's that time of year. So just reminding you, just in case you've forgotten. Well, let's talk briefly about some things that have come up this week on the discussion boards. And one of the big ones that came up this week has been some back and forth discussions about how various tax software were handling qualified business income issues when you have an S corporation or partnership that the taxpayer owns an interest in, which obviously reports out QBI information and W-2 wages and UBIA information, but the taxpayer has a disallowed passive loss. And that's kind of an issue because the software appears to be reporting the exact QBI shown on the K-1 in many cases. At least two different software programs have been reported to do this. That includes regardless of whether the entire loss has been disallowed. So let's say that you have a $5,000 loss coming to you, out to you from an S corporation. Your taxpayer does not materially participate. Therefore, your taxpayer gets none of the $5,000 loss because they have no other passive income. But the S corporation return shows a $5,000 negative QBI. Well, it turns out that this is not being blocked if the passive activity rules, as in that case, block it. It's also generally not being blocked, it seems, when software notices that we're out of basis, so we have a disallowance of the loss because of basis issues, or we have a disallowance due to at-risk problems. This approach is, I guess, in one sense, if you want to kind of take a look at this as expanding the view of 1.199 Cap A-6, that we determine things at the RPE level, that, well, you know, maybe they're taking the position that, yeah, you just have it flow through, and we don't adjust the number. And maybe that's arguably their position. But it appears tough to reconcile this with the disallowed loss rules found in Regulation 1.199 Cap A-2B4. In essence, do those disallowed loss rules, which discuss passive losses and the like, does that only apply to activities the taxpayer owns 100% of, which means for practical purposes, it would apply only to rentals for most taxpayers, because very few taxpayers are going to own 100% of an activity that's not a rental that is otherwise going to be passive. So that would seem like an unusual structure. It also discusses basis, and it seems difficult for that type of loss to be involved if there's not a pass-through entity in play. So it appears to be difficult to understand how that rule works with the rules there on disallowed losses. My guess is it's not really the software companies have yet decided this is how it should be done. It may very well be more under the standard problem that we have these days, that the software companies are somewhat overwhelmed, that there's a whole bunch of things they have to code, that this does not have a clear, nice, simple, easy way to resolve the problem. And so for that reason, they are doing what they've done quite a bit during tax season, which is they're essentially punting the issue. This is going to be one of those where the individual person preparing the return is going to have to figure out what the adjustments should be and handle those adjustments on their own. The software does not appear at this point in many cases to be attempting any sort of adjustment. Now, again, potentially, maybe they have this tied down. Maybe the IRS has talked to them. They've talked to the IRS, gotten guidance that no, you just flow through the RPE numbers. That would be, in one sense, it would make sense compared to how we end up handling trusts, where trusts have this QBI that kind of floats independently of whatever flows out of the trust to the beneficiary. You know, we just worry about DNI, and whatever percent of DNI you get, that's the percent of QBI you get. So maybe that's the theory, but I kind of doubt it. I really think that that's giving more credit than maybe due here. I just think that realistically, they're picking up the number from the K-1, and there's not an obvious worksheet or any other publication that tells you how to adjust that, so they're just not attempting it. In any event, you need to make your decisions about what your software is doing here and whether or not you agree with it. And if you don't agree, then you're going to have to do some tracing on your own and doing some overrides. Again, this is becoming kind of a recurring theme we've seen in software and dealing with the 199 Cap A situation in the past year. Now let's talk about the cases that came down this week. One that got a lot of coverage is Gaylord versus Mnuchin, which is case number 18277 and 18280. This case came down from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And it dealt with overriding a decision of a U.S. district court in Wisconsin. The district court had held that the provision of the minister's housing allowance allowed by IRC section 107 parenthesis 2, it's a weird section, it doesn't have A, B, it starts with 1, 2, that particular provision of the code violated the establishment clause of the U.S. Constitution. That amounted to the federal government's establishment of a religion. That's something which is not allowed per the Constitution. Therefore, you know, they can't discriminate and only allow this allowance to be given to ministers. Not surprisingly, the case was appealed. It was also the district court judge was aware that this ruling probably had some issues when it went to appeal. So they agreed to stay the ruling until such time as the Court of Appeals ruled on how this worked. Well, the Court of Appeals, in this case, the panel unanimously reversed the decision on a 3-0 panel decision. They unanimously reversed the decision of the district court, holding that the housing allowance was acceptable. They kind of rejected the idea that, wait, everybody else has to deal with Section 119, which has very strict rules, limits you to having housing on the premises. And therefore, you know, they were saying that basically, so we're kind of okay with 107.1, which is a parsonage provided on the church grounds, that, okay, that's like 119, that's equivalent. But this housing allowance where we pay somebody and they can use those funds for, you know, to provide for their housing, to find housing and, you know, pay for it. And it does not have to be right on the employer's grounds or a property owned by the employer. Well, you know, they say we think that goes too far, was the argument that was being made in the district court level. This court said no. They said while 119 is there, there are other types of housing exclusions that Congress has provided. Specifically, they pointed to the military housing exclusion. You know, we have in certain cases, military are allowed to get housing expenses. They talked about the foreign housing exclusion. You know, when you have foreign, under the foreign housing rules, that you can exclude amounts paid to you for foreign housing. They said because of that, this is something that Congress has done in various specific cases, and this is just one more such specific case. And because of that, we believe it passes constitutional muster. They also argued that attempting to decide in Section 119, which I think is a little more iffy argument they went down, because the problem here is, I think the same problem they're addressing, determining what relates to their business or convenience of the employer for 119, it's the same type of problem we're going to run into when you decide to what relates to your work as a, you know, minister of the gospel, which is what the regs tell us have for 107. It's like, yeah, I think that one's kind of a six of one, half dozen of the other type of situation. But nevertheless, they ruled that this was a constitutional exercise. And probably the stronger argument, I think, and again, I'm not a constitutional law scholar, but the stronger argument is we just had a whole bunch of other special situations. So the fact they had one more is not really a problem. In any event, it did not impermissibly violate the Establishment Clause. Theoretically, this case could go to the U.S. Supreme Court, but I have a feeling the Supreme Court's not going to have much interest in picking it up. So if you did have ministers that were concerned that we're going to lose the housing allowance, they were going to somehow, you know, now have their housing allowance be taxed, that threat appears to have been quashed at this point. There certainly doesn't appear to be any likelihood that I see that that's going to happen anytime soon. Next, let's go talk about a pilot here. Well, for that case was good news if you were a minister. This case is bad news for the pilot in question. Grudzeal versus Commissioner, Task Court Memorandum Decision 2019-20. This particular case deals with a pilot for Delta Airlines. This pilot had found and obtained a vintage World War II fighter. And it's kind of an interesting plane. In fact, the tax court judge described some details of this plane. He picked up what was a Fairey Firefly. And this particular model of plane had only been introduced late in World War II. So unlike other planes of the World War II vintage, there weren't very many of these that were actually made and used in combat, and there weren't very many of them, therefore, that were ever around. You know, there was not huge orders for this particular model after the war ended. It was a British plane. So what happened was that he found one of these and he restored it. And he paid quite a bit of money to restore the plane. You know, it was not super cheap to acquire. So he paid $400,000 to buy the plane, $60,000 to ship it to the U.S. because he found it in Australia. It had been part of the Australian Air Force. The one he found had been part of the Australian Air Force, and a collector down there had purchased it, partially restored it, but it was, so I think they said about 60% restored. Obviously, you can't get spare parts for a plane like that. You know, it's the only one left. In fact, this plane eventually became the only flyable version of this plane, at least through 2014. 2014, he crashed the plane. So he still has the plane, but it's not in flying mode anymore. He had to basically create and build his own spare parts for the plane to restore it. He did all of that work and actually got it FAA certified. Now, in order to fly the plane, you also have to be certified as a pilot or skill in that area. And he was also able to convince the FAA to certify him as a pilot on this plane. So he was the one and only person in the U.S. who had, or apparently the world, that had a Fairey Firefly and that was allowed to fly the Firefly too. So he was the only pilot who could fly it and he had the only plane. Well, he wanted to give paid rides on this plane because it, you know, it was a vintage plane, created a lot of interest. But he discovered that the FAA is not really too keen on you offering paid rides on this plane that wasn't really certified for passenger use. You know, he's trying to just do it as a sideline. They just aren't real keen on that concept, so he could not get it approved for that. He nevertheless continued to put this on his schedule, on his tax return as a Schedule C. He continued to list it as aircraft leasing, even though it was never leased. He did take it to air shows, and it won prizes, including at the Oshkosh Air Show, you know, after restoring it. It got a lot of attention. You know, he continued to take it to air shows. He continued to fly it. He had invested about $1.6 million into this plane. So when he started treating it as a trader business and started depreciating it, he was getting about $80,000 a year in depreciation. And he was also just had other expenses. So his total losses claimed every year were in excess of six figures for the years that were under exam. And in none of his years, you know, I realized he had $8,000 depreciation, but the court pointed out in none of those years did his income exceed his cash outflows. So he was desperately underwater every year. Now, there was a possibility, though, and so the court took a look at this and said, I wonder if he, you know, had a profit motive. And the court did mention, I thought it was kind of interesting in passing, the reference to this test that's involved for whether or not you have a trade or business, whether or not you have profit motive. And the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, we already mentioned them, you know, had previously referred to this as a, what we find in the regs, they referred to that in the Roberts case in 2016, as a goofy test. In the Seventh Circuit, they're not using this, this basically the nine-factor test. But the court noted this case would go to the Ninth Circuit, so they did look at the nine factors. So the nine factors are found in Regulation 1.183-2A. And its theory is we look at each of these and we balance them to see whether they're pro or con. And they go through the factors. Now, most of the factors worked against the taxpayer or were neutral. But one that potentially worked in their favor was that there was an expectation that this plane would appreciate in value. And that by that increase in value, because there was testimony that these type of vintage aircraft do become more valuable over time. And clearly, you know, he could expect potentially that he would get back his $1.6 million he put in the plane, plus potentially the amounts that he was losing every year, negative cash flow to keep the plane flying and take it to air shows, because that would allow him to sell the plane at this big gain. So the court said, well, that's a possibility, and that could create a profit motive. But the court decided ultimately it didn't really look like that's what we had. They said, and whether you use a nine-factor test or the Seventh Circuit uses what the court termed a more holistic approach, whichever system you used, it didn't look good. They said a real problem occurred here, because the court noted that, well, hey, the plane crashed in 2014. The court said, well, yeah, that's not really crucial right now because it hadn't crashed for the years under exam. So you're not trying, you know, he's not trying to claim losses after the plane crashed, at least not for the years under exam. But they said, but that was useful in a different way. He said, you know, the taxpayer admitted that this vintage of plane, flying it, presented certain risks. And obviously, a plane that has been crashed is going to be worth substantially less than a plane that is still airworthy. And the court noted, despite those risks, he continued to fly the plane, right, for 15 years after it was restored. 15 years after the restoration, after it went to those air shows like in Oshkosh and won the grand prize. The court noted, if you were going to sell it for appreciation 15 years ago, when the plane had just won those awards and just been restored and was getting all this press coverage, that would have been the time to sell the plane. The fact that he did not sell it then, didn't even attempt to sell it then, and didn't even try to get an appraisal on the plane until apparently the crash in 2014, suggested to the court that realistically he was not looking at the increase in value as his profit motive for this plane. Rather, as the IRS was suggesting, he's a guy that just likes tinkering with planes and he likes flying them. And because of that, and he had enough income to allow him to offset this. So he could afford to do it. And because of that, the court found that there was no true profit motive. And because of that, the losses were disallowed. This is not surprising. If you have a series of losses for many years, which he did, large losses many years, the IRS almost always will eventually come knocking, asking you what's happening. It's bad if it looks like, when you have things like this, it always looks bad. And this is kind of the Seventh Circuit's holistic approach. As a practical matter, if the taxpayer has a lot of other income and resources, does not need this to make money, it's something that clearly is something that the taxpayer enjoys doing recreationally. And the taxpayer does not seem to take the types of steps that would make sense if somebody truly was just trying to do it for profit reasons. And the big problem is, if somebody really was doing this solely for the profit motive, they probably wouldn't keep operating it when it was losing money every year. That's always been a big problem. Why are you doing this? You're not changing how you're doing it. You're losing tons of money every year. Or number two, like in this case, even if you do have this theory that it will appreciate in value, you don't really seem to be trying to figure out when's the best time to sell it and how to get the most value for it. And so not surprising in this case that the taxpayer at the end of the day was found not to have a profit motive, and the loss was disallowed. Revenue ruling 2019-09 did something rather unusual. This was issued on March the 21st. Now, the IRS and the Treasury are conducting a study on Section 355 of the Internal Revenue Code. 355 deals with spinning out controlled corporations, right? You know, we want to split up a corporation, so I want to try to piece it out. And generally with 355, if it works, you're allowed to take a single corporation and you can separate out a portion of that corporation that represents a separate trade or business and spin that out tax-free to the shareholders while retaining a trade or business inside the other corporation. One of the requirements is we have to have two active trades or businesses that be carried on for specific periods of time. It's all defined in Section 355. And where we're going to see the active trade or business definition is found at 355B. Well, the IRS back in the 1950s had issued a couple of revenue rulings dealing with the concept of an active trade or business. And the revenue rulings 57464 and 57492. Those rulings both suggested that you could not have an active trade or business if, in fact, there was no revenue coming into the company. So it was, you know, they don't specifically say that, but they strongly suggest it was a major factor in why in those two fact patterns, where we have some, you know, different structures they're putting in, why those fact patterns, they couldn't come up with a 355 transaction that worked. The IRS has begun studying 355 because, you know, there are some discussions about companies that are conducting some major research operations that would like to spin out the research portion only and have that be a separate trade or business and try to spin that out in a separate entity that would be done on a tax-free basis. Of course, the problem is, and the IRS announced this last year, and the revenue ruling today actually refers you back to the page where they have that discussion, where they're going to be looking at and studying whether that would make sense to allow that sort of 355 transaction. Well, in the end, they said in the interim, you know, the IRS will rule in this area and we're still studying how it works. Well, apparently they noticed that we had these two old rulings. But they didn't just basically say they no longer are applicable. They didn't like revoke the rulings. They simply suspended them. They're saying, look, we think these rulings may be read to indicate that a lack of revenue bars active trade or business treatment. That's not how we're going to be handling this right now. So we are suspending these rulings. Now, suspending is a step separate from revoking the rulings. They didn't revoke them. In theory, this means they could come back unchanged. I suspect that won't be the case. I suspect they may come back in different form. And, you know, the answer to one or the other may change as far as an active trade or business, or it may not change for either one. I think they didn't want to revoke because revoke might suggest that, well, the answer is going to be these are each trade or businesses. They're not ready to state that. But it is highly unusual. The service does not very often suspend. In fact, they had to actually reference people back to the Internal Revenue Manual section that describes what suspension means because they assume that most people would not be aware of what suspended meant. For a revenue ruling, want to say, well, it is allowed. The Internal Revenue Manual describes how we can suspend a ruling. So these rulings are suspended if you're involved in corporate structures, if you're involved, especially in ones that are dealing with research activities, and you have a company that wants to try to do this sort of 355 distribution. You want to pay attention to this study. And this is just a little more information about what's going on in that area. Well, I was almost ready to finish everything up. I was done for the week. We had all the material. And then suddenly notice 2019-25 came out on Friday. March the 22nd, the IRS issued notice 2019-25. 2019-25 modifies notice 2019-11 that was issued earlier in the year. 2019-11 was issued just before the filing season got underway. It was issued in mid-January. Just before the IRS is going to start accepting tax returns. And what that notice said was that because of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, because people were confused about what the proper income would be, what their tax was going to be, how their withholdings were going to work, that the IRS was going to waive the underpayment of estimated tax rules if a taxpayer had paid in at least 85% of their taxes by January 15th. Now, that's down from the 90% rule we normally have. If they don't meet the, and by the, and also kind of got rid of the whole, you had to do it evenly during the year. If you don't meet 85%, though, you go back to the old rule. And the reality of that was you also went to 90% was your test or the prior year's tax. So some people complained, there were more complaints that there were people who were still underpaid this year. Some people are getting stuck with some issues and special cases. So there was some pressure put on to grant more relief. The Treasury Secretary Mnuchin last week, the prior week, had indicated to Congress that he was okay, supportive of, you know, granting more relief and going down to, let's say, 80%. But what happened this week in Notice 2019-25 is we now got that number dropped to 80%. So as long as you paid in, as long as the taxpayer paid in 80% of the total tax ultimately due by January 15th, they're not subject to underpayment of estimated tax payment penalty. Now, of course, the problem is, you know, and that's good news in one sense, but here's two problems. First problem, your software may automatically be checking the 85% rule now, but it's certainly not checking the 80% rule. So now you better stop and take a close look. Any return has underpaid estimated tax penalty. You need to go back and see if the 80% rule would work. I think Treasury suggested that this would basically allow about 15% of the people who are underpaid, who are being penalized, no longer be penalized. So it's going to be a number, you know, it's not going to be an insignificant number of returns that are going to be impacted. And the other problem is, what if the taxpayer had already filed the return and paid the tax? Well, Treasury suggests filing a Form 843. That's the claim for refund form, right? You know, or may remember that form. It's not used really often, but you do have that. It is the claim for refund and request for abatement of tax. And we've all kind of used it in special cases. Well, this turns out to be one of those special cases. So if your taxpayer has already done it. Now, what's not totally clear is, of course, what's going to happen to taxpayers who maybe have filed their return. They've set up, they're going to have electronic payment withdrawal, but now that withdrawal is going to be the wrong number. Is there any way to stop that system? My guess is probably not. And so they may still have to file the 843. In any event, it's going to be interesting to see how that works. I mean, some discussion may be talking about trying to use a superseded return to put another 1040 in the mix. And that's a possibility. I just don't know how the IRS system is going to react to that. I understand the legal basis of superseded return. But whether the practical side of it's going to work in this case, who knows how the computers react. I also found it interesting the IRS did not apparently feel that they could identify taxpayers who would qualify for this relief. You know, that kind of suggests that, as some people have kind of thought over the years, the IRS has trouble figuring out under payment penalties, like when things were paid and how that works. They tend to have trouble with the software getting it to work. My guess is they just decided that that'd be too big a programming project for them to go back, figure out who had paid in a penalty that shouldn't have paid it in and just refund that balance. In any event, taxpayers who are affected, apparently the official guidance tells you you need to file a Form 843 if they've already filed the return, and that's how you're going to get the money back by doing the claim for refund. Not fun, probably not something you look forward to, not one of those great post-tax season deals. So yeah, check your returns you're letting go now. Make sure we don't have an 80% return that's get qualifies for relief that's putting out with a 2210 penalty. But then also you're gonna have to figure out who was impacted during the year and then bring those clients back in, you know, file 843s. I suspect software vendors will put out at least scanning programs that will look for returns that appear to be affected by this. Maybe we'll get here sometime in the next week plus. Our software will be updated to look for this. That's kind of one of those systems. I'm sure it drives the vendors crazy because it's like, do we really want to touch the software right now and potentially break it? But so you don't want to rush a change out, but you also know that you're now doing returns that are technically charging penalties that shouldn't be. So it's going to be an interesting run for the software vendors who've had enough fun this year dealing with the new tax law. Well, this is just one more thing. We are getting to the end of tax season. Yes, we're within it. I guess I saw earlier, what was it, Friday? There were 25 days left till April 15th. So now we're down below that. We're going to go below 20 here, days left to the 15th. So we are approaching the time where actually tax season will end. Don't hear anything more recently about extending tax season. We had that introduced bill, but nothing seems to happen. So apparently we may actually end on April 15th. Make sure you take a look at your state society catalogs. Take a look at the courses going to be offering this year. We're going to be offering courses that are live. Some state societies are going to offer them live and going to be broadcast courses. So be sure to take a look for that, the offerings in the catalogs. We're going to be doing courses on a bunch of topics this year. Going to continue to talk about 199 Cap A because still a lot of confusion in that area. But also all the standard topics. We again have the partnership audit rules. Remember those things? They're still happening. And we have to be dealing with those other great issues in tax and, of course, whatever else the Congress may come up with, because we also expect sometime this year probably to see the technical corrections. Well, we'll at least hope we do. So in any event, make sure you check your state societies, find your training for this year, get your continuing education in place, and we'll hopefully see you in the classes. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments here for this week of March the 25th. You can catch our updates posted on the website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. On Twitter, my handle there is @edzollers, and I also follow a number of online discussions. I follow the subreddit at reddit.com/r/taxpros. There I have discussions on various tax-related matters. I also participate in the California Society of CPAs Tax Talk group, where you can find it on Yahoo Groups. And I also am part of or follow the Connect sites for three state societies I'm a member of. That is for Arizona, New Jersey, and Minnesota. And I tend to step in and I'll see if there's something of interest. I may answer questions there. So if you see me there, you can post messages, post questions. On those locations, it's not just me. There's going to be a whole bunch of people there who are very competent answering questions, back and forth discussions among CPAs. It's a very useful resource if you have access to it. So make sure you take a look at those. We'll see how this week goes. We've got another week, more fun. Who knows what's going to happen? This week looked to be nice and simple right till Friday when suddenly we got that change in underpayment. So who knows what other surprises remain for tax season. So take care. Have a good week where you don't apparently work too many hours. And we'll see you next week here on Current Federal Tax Developments.